As an odd response to the fascinating collection of work you put together for the journal, I've just played you the second side of an LP of 1968, republished in 1976, of the Incredible String Band, who in subsequent history, when recuperated and remembered, come to be known as psychedelic folk or acid folk actually. And they're a group I listen to a lot, and I went to their big concert in the Albert Hall in 68 or 69. And I think it was, this comes back to some things I was talking about, to the Tinkerbell and the performance of Peter Pan, that it's one of those kind of great missed moments, because everyone is smoking so much dope that they miss it. And yet it's quite remarkable concert and gives rise to complex musical and social relations. And I don't know, I just guess when you listen to a record like that cold, I mean, Robin Williams' melismas must be some of the great melismas in musical history, really. You know, not high, low, anything like that. They're just amazing. And their technique is, on the one hand, focused, on the other hand, quite avant-garde, in the sense that there are complex repetitions that seem as if they're never going to stop, but have slight modal variations. There's collage, there's the bursting out between different forms of folk, and the ironic taking back of the hymn, "I don't have no home on this earth anymore," from Woody Guthrie, for a, you know, kind of post-militant folk interpreting, which, you know, belongs to the moment of Dylan as well. So it's a kind of vastly complex and beautifully sung musical text. And it's also, in what you heard, the most extraordinary sound. It's a two-channel production by an American producer, a famous one whose name I now forget, who wrote a book about that moment called White Bicycles. And I kind of wanted to start there, because going back and looking for that concert again was one of those moments of going back and looking for, it was the beginning of my going and looking for what must have been enough at the time. And how does one forget it? And at the same time, in forgetting it, how does it last a lifetime? And somehow come to seem more important than Heidegger, for example. You know, the remarkable unanswered question. You know, who needs sign and sight after that? Anyway, so I wanted to play you that, and I wanted you to hear it as a way of coming back and responding to what you heard in Ruskin, and also because that takes me back to just when I started this whole project, which is 9 years ago, when I left Middlesex and started trying to write what I talk about there and have talked about ever since 2007, which is this unexplored meeting of the personal and the political. You know, about how did we miss it and how can we hold to it? So that's the beginning. So can I, it'd be nice to ask you what you think of that as something to listen to. As someone who makes music and likes melisma, I know that.
I mean, I'd never heard the Incredible String Band before, so it was a fantastic experience, but also had moments of recognition, just tiny seconds where they reverberated with something I knew or something I thought I knew from around that era, or that has been passed down in maybe another influence, musical influence I have. But what I think was really interesting is the kind of mood that it set in relation perhaps to a very different set of moods, say, that you were invoking at the Ruskin, which were a different set of materials, and this makes sense of some of those. And of course, with a very provocative comment about Heidegger as well, I'm prompted to think about those pieces of music which could replace similar texts for me.
Yes, that's, and the other thing I wanted to think about this and realise on looking at YouTubes of them is so long after, in a kind of post-colonial, post-colonial moment of Otto Lith and Achille Mbembe and Fred Moten and whoever, is that of all the people who took up Indian music in that period, where it was the Beatles or whoever, they're the only ones who were possessed by it, who didn't set out to possess it, but were totally possessed by it. So the modes of ragas and, in fact, Levantine music pass into the substance of their singing, the substance of their use of Western musical genres as well, I think. And they're simply possessed by it. And if when you look at the YouTubes, this is something one can observe. I think you can observe. And with George Harrison and the Beatles, it's always showing off. And with them, it's almost as if they're using the sitar to cut themselves out from the received. And at the same time, the better to receive it, because their insertion in the folk tradition is incredibly complex and learned. And they're kind of, you know, working class Glasgow kids, so that matters too. And then I also think that they're invoking of a kind of heteroclite imagery, which was important to me because I was always interested in Christian mysticism on the one hand. And then The Ducks on the Pond is deliberately about the Cluny tapestries, The Lady and the Unicorn, which again is one of the things that interests art historians in their enigma. You know, it's a kind of foundational thing in art history, that tapestry cycle. It's curious again to go back and see how do they handle it? How do they take that art historical problem? How do they process it in a way that I couldn't really? And it's not exhaustive, but it's not simple either. So I think that again is a kind of marker. Not to say how little happens in the intervening 40 or 50 years, but how much, when you fall on chance and strange intersections, you've already known. So that's what I mean about this weird thing of the post-colonial moment being there, not in Spivak and Derrida just, but also in these kids from Glasgow, who eventually were ruined by Scientology. You know, easy come, hard to go, you can say, or hard to come, easy to go. And ruin their discs by having girlfriends singing mystical choruses. So that's another instance, I think. And I think what I felt I had to do after reading through these interventions of in or around or on or coming out of the Ruskin lecture is that the only way for me to respond is to try to say something else, like to keep moving. Because in a very complex way, I don't want to talk about the individual essays, but this holding one to taking absolutely the seriously the idea of the last line first, and then absolutely seriously the need to find a beginning, and the way in which the essays, the art historical essays around it, interact between the transcription on the one hand and the world that is absolutely theirs and not mine on the other, is, it's just remarkable to me to see how that space, which I didn't know I was inventing, is then occupied in these constellations and these movements in and out of it and these appropriations of it. So the only thing in a way for me to respond is to say something other, to say something different, to fill in the dossier of lost documents, if you like.
One of the things I remember about that lecture is your gesture of also the gasp, which isn't taken up so much, I guess, explicitly.
No.
But really marked the way that you inhabited that space at that time.
Yes, it's a funny thing because Griselda's very interested in the gasp as well and has been writing a piece about it, quite unbeknownst to each other. But my realization of it in a way came from Manuel de Oliveira's film, which I have shown clips of. I think in my very first PowerPoint I showed a clip. And his film La Lettre, The Letter, which is his filmed version of Madame de Lafayette's novel, La Princesse de Clèves, which is, I mean, Lafayette writing in the in the later 17th century set her novels amongst the royal families and of nobilities of earlier in the century and the end of the 16th century, because she argued in a little essay that it's not that you're prying on people's real private lives, but it's more titillating if all these people bear the names of aristocrats who are still existing families. You know, it brings back the density of political history, the Fronde, the wars, you know, livens the regime of Louis XIV. And it's a very, very long and complex story of a young woman who is too well brought up by her mother, the novel, and thus unable to acknowledge infidelity, or able to acknowledge it only in a way that she can't live it out as any other person would have done, with lovers and mistresses, but it kills her, in the process kills everyone around her. And the novel, the film is set in some very abstract late 1990s Paris, very wealthy people all bearing the aristocratic names of the people in the text, but interspersed with two figures of culture, one of whom is the Portuguese pianist, Marijão Pires, and the other of whom is a Portuguese rock singer called Pedro Abrunhosa, who play themselves in the film. And Pires, just by playing the piano, plays the world of perfect manners. And Abrunhosa plays the world in which those manners are broken, but which through fame and success and glory they can come to know each other. And in that context, the young princess meets Abrunhosa, who falls desperately in love with her. And the film is remarkable because it's some of it's just shot in real time in these very curious ways that Oliveira is able to film. It's a combination of very traditional avant-garde and, so I should say, traditional techniques and narrative techniques and avant-garde techniques with a lot of intertitles, like silent cinema. And no one knows that Abrunhosa has fallen in love with her, or that she is affected by this love. And there's a scene in which you see her mother, herself, her husband, her mother's best friend, and her husband, and they're all watching the television, and you're behind the television, the viewers are behind the television. And the camera watches them listening to the news in real time. And the report of this and that and the other, and then in a car accident, the singer Pedro Abrunhosa has been injured, and you see her go, "Ah!" and put her hand to the mouth. And the family and friends look down at her, and then the camera does a reverse shot to face the television, next to which is standing her husband. And he lowers his face and begins to die of shame. And after that, the film unfolds to her disappearance off to do a charitable work in Africa, and she writes a letter back about it, and that's the letter of the title. So it's, if you like, it's a kind of restoration of something to contemporary culture which can't be seen. you know, in the kind of unbridled sexual modernity of the internet or whatever. It's not a critique of it. It's just restoring something which is driven out by this discourse, that there can be impossibility. And the whole thing articulates around the ha! At which point everyone knows, but no one can speak. So that's, if you like, is the... And that sent me one of the tracks of looking for these gasp moments and of coupling the gasp moments with moments where, not in this film, but in other films, people say, realise something awful has happened and say, let's start over. So I started building a sub-iconography of scenes where characters say, let's start over, which is normally the inauguration of a disaster, not of a renewal. And so that trying to find that dual iconography for the gasp became, if you like, an iconography of different forms of impossibility. And that's something else I was talking about, which the commentaries and the insistence in the transcriptions pick up on, of saying that I was trying to build this, you know, these series of films which would speak for me, and they would become my enunciation. I would become as if theirs. So the ones spoken about there, the Lubitsch, that everything is the tip of another iceberg. I think that's it. The problem is not the tip, but constructing the iceberg.
You would become the films in the same way as the string band.
Because, yes, it's to be possessed by. I think that's it. I gave a lecture to the students at the Rijksacademy on being possessed and on the way in which, if you don't take theory theoretically, because someone talks about theory in that, I think, if you take theory as something which possesses you as a necessity, then at the point that possession fails, your self-possession of that possession fails, then theory is a disappointment, always.
Which is why I think you talk in not so kind of gentle terms about the ideas of kind of application.
Mm. Yeah.
This distance from something to be applied. And that's perhaps significant in the wider context of the project, in that often people are thinking, how do, for example, studio artists apply theory? And they conceive of that as a problem, and then having conceived it as a problem, it becomes answerable by a solution.
By a rule, yes. And the rule is often just a citational one, isn't it? That you have to quote this properly. And you have to quote it so that it makes sense in terms of the user's sociology to be able to show, is a field of champ, a habitus in Bourdieu's sense of quotations, of citation ability. And again, very much when one of my earliest articles on these questions, which was a Down on the Upbeat, I was desperately trying to quote a passage from Adorno, which I knew would have all my friends at Blot magazine squealing with envy, in it, no other reason. I thought it was very beautiful, and every time I transcribed into a paragraph of my text, it stopped making any kind of sense at all. It made no sense in terms of my enunciation. So the question was, forget it. I think I just put it in the end. But I was so unable to apply it that I just put it in arbitrarily. Thought, it will do there. It is a signifier. But it can't. It can't be applied. All you can do in the end is to take it for some kind of a walk through your text and drop it somewhere, and then let someone else pick up the consequences.